We've been reading through the Gospel of Mark, and this morning we're going to do what any student of literature says you should probably never do. We're going to fast forward, and we're going to read the end before having gone all the way through the middle. We're jumping ahead to that final hour, to the actual moment of Jesus' death. One of the most striking features of the account of Jesus' last moments, and all the gospel writers go to great lengths to draw out this point, is that the events of Jesus' death all happened in the dark. The betrayal, the abandonment, the denial, the mistrial, all of it happened at night. And now when we get to the ultimate moment, to the moment of Jesus' death, there is this inexplicable, mysterious darkness that settles over the land. Mark 15:33. At the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land, and it lasted until the ninth hour. The sixth hour is about noon. The ninth hour, about 3 p.m., from 12 o'clock till 3 p.m., absolute darkness. It's mysterious. It's inexplicable. A lot of people have gone to great lengths to try and account for it. Maybe there's a natural cause. Maybe a solar eclipse. We're all about the eclipse right now, right? April the 8th, you've got your solar glasses ready. I've been reading about how to photograph it. But here's the thing about eclipse, that moment of totality, when the sun is in full eclipse, it lasts only 2 or 3 minutes. It doesn't create darkness for the whole afternoon. Besides, it can only happen at the time of a particular orbit that the moon is in. Can't happen at the full moon, and Passover always happens at the time of the full moon. Other people have said, well, maybe it was, a sirocco, one of those wild desert storms that kicks up so much sand into the atmosphere that it obscures the sun for days at a time. But this is the wet season, the time of Passover. Siroccos didn't happen that time of year. This is a mysterious, eerie, supernatural phenomenon. But what does it mean? Jesus, the Lord of all creation, hangs there suffering, gasping, breathing out his final bit of air, and it's almost as if creation itself aches and groans with him and the world goes dark. It signifies something, doesn't it? But what does it signify? It signifies the darkness we face in our own lives. It signifies the darkness Jesus faced in those moments. But most importantly, it points to what's really going on, where somehow those two darknesses, ours and Jesus, cancel out. The darkness of Jesus dispels the darkness in our lives. Something happened in those moments, something that broke the grip of darkness in our lives, something staggering, almost unthinkable, unimaginable, and wondrous. Jesus' darkness broke the grip of the darkness in our own lives. So that's what we're going to look at together. We're going to look at the darkness that we face, at the darkness that Jesus faced, and how the two come together to dispel and eradicate darkness in the world. Let's think first about what we face. Well, in the Bible, physical darkness always represents or points to something deeper, a kind of spiritual darkness. When Jesus is arrested, this little detail is not in the Gospel of Mark, but you find it in Luke. This is what it says, Luke 22, verse 53. Jesus said to the chief priests and the elders who had come for him, "This is your hour. This is the hour when darkness reigns." Jesus is using darkness here as a metaphor, the same way the Bible does. A metaphor that for everything that's going wrong in us and everything that is awry in the world. Physical darkness is a metaphor for spiritual darkness. What is spiritual darkness? When the Bible talks about it, it's referring to what happens when we turn away from God and face something else. In the Bible, God is always likened to the sun. The sun is the source of truth because it's only in the light that you can really see things the way they are. The sun is the source of life because without it, everything that lives withers and dies. So God, the source of all light and truth, if you place your life in orbit around him, the inevitable result is an awareness of those things, light and truth. But imagine for a second that you turn your back on the light. All you will ever see of the world is shadow. Your shadow cast on the wall, the eerie shadows of the world around you. If you place your life in orbit around anything else, if your career is more important to you than God, if relationship is more important to you than God, if your family is more important to you than God, you may come to church, you may even take notes during the sermon, you may believe in God, but if you are not in orbit around him as the center of your life, the Bible is clear that the inevitable result is darkness. That's not God cursing the world. That's just true. That's the result of our choice. If you turn your back to the light, all you really see of the world is shadows on the wall. When you place something else in the center, in the place that God alone claims to be the most important in your life, the result is a kind of, disorientation. Something disorienting about the darkness, isn't there? Our world, filled with electricity and gadgetry, we rarely, if ever, experience total darkness, do we? There's just so much ambient light in the GTA. Even when the power goes out, there's still light. We can't even see most of the stars at night. But if you have ever been in complete, utter, total darkness, I mean, you can't see an inch in front of you. You can't see your own hand held up to your face. If you stay in that kind of darkness for any length of time, it's radically disoriented. It has horrible effects. It's why it has been used as a method of torture, now outlawed. It has catastrophic effects on the mind and the body. Ever heard of Ernest Shackleton? Incredible story. Shackleton was a British explorer. 1914, he takes a ship, the Endurance, on a voyage to Antarctica. They planned to sail into Antarctica and then disembark from the boat and then walk across to the South Pole. They planned to be the first people to circumnavigate and wind up at the South Pole. They never got there. Their ship got caught in the polar ice and it was crushed. And over the next 2 months, their expedition turned into this harrowing effort just to get home. It's an amazing story, worth reading. Surprised they haven't made it into a movie yet. Maybe they have. They all survive. There I go, giving away the ending again. But in an account of the expedition, Shackleton's biographer said that of all the things they faced, starvation, brutal cold, the worst thing was the darkness. At the South Pole, in the middle of May, the sun goes down and it doesn't rise again until late in July. No light for 3 months. This is what the biographer said. In all the world, there is no desolation more complete than the polar night. No warmth, no life, no movement. And only those who have experienced it can fully appreciate what it means to be without the sun day after day, week after week. Few unaccustomed to it can fight off its effects, and it has driven many men mad. If you are in darkness, absolute darkness, for any length of time, you become radically disoriented. Physical darkness, spiritual darkness. Physical darkness, you can't see forward. You don't know where you're going. You can't even see yourself. You don't know what you look like. You don't know where your body parts are. You can't see the people around you. Are they friendly? Are they foes? You're utterly isolated in the dark. In the dark, you can't see forward. You can't see yourself. You can't see those around you. Spiritual darkness is the same. You have a problem with purpose. You can't see your way forward. Why am I really here? You can't envision the future anymore. I mean, maybe there's periods where you feel, yeah, I've got something to live for, a career goal, an aspiration, a big purchase that I'm longing for. But when you actually attain it and you realize it isn't enough, It's not big enough to fill your soul. You start to experience again that sense of meaninglessness, of purposelessness, that spiritual darkness. And then secondly, if you center on anything but God, you're going to struggle with identity. By that, I mean that most of us have an identity that's fragile. It's insecure. It's based on things that we're centering our life on that are perishable. Human approval goes up, goes down. How well we're performing. We have good days, we have bad days. What's parked in the driveway? We feel great about it until it rusts itself and they haul it away. You don't know really who you are because you're insecure and you've oriented your life around things that cannot last. Spiritual darkness means you can't see forward, you can't see yourself. And lastly, it means in every way that matters, you are isolated. You get so wrapped up in the things that we think we're living for. They're either scaring you because you could lose them, or they're making you angry because as much as you want them, you can't have them. Or they're making you proud because, hey, you have them, but other people don't. Or they're making you filled with self-pity because you feel like maybe I just don't really deserve them. Or they just make you an insanely driven person. As a result, though, it isolates you from people. It kills relationship. Spiritual darkness ultimately leads to disintegration. And in the Bible, darkness and disintegration, these go together. If you take something out of the light long enough, a plant, for example, it withers, dies, and disintegrates into dust. But the Bible's talking about something even more drastic than that. Think with me. Let's go back to Genesis 1, all the way to the beginning. Genesis 1:1. Actually, Genesis chapter 1, verse 0. You don't have it in your Bible. It's not really there, but Genesis 1 tells you what Genesis 0 was like. It says there was darkness. Darkness over the face of the deep. The earth was formless and void. There was nothing. Desolation. And then what happened next? God said, let there be light. And through the creative power of God, light breaks through into the darkness. Order begins to emerge in the chaos. God brings things together. He integrates them. He begins to fold things into beautiful artistic creations. There's purpose, there's meaning, there's coherence. That's creation. And then the Bible goes on to say that when we move away from God, the result, spiritual darkness, it's more than just feeling a little bit disoriented. Where am I? I'm bumping into the walls. It's actually disintegration. It's chaos. You're moving backwards. It's uncreation. You're moving back into the darkness. The prophet Isaiah put it this way. He said, woe is me. I am undone. I'm a man of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips. My eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. He realized when he finally turned from the shadows into the face of the light, how disintegrated his life had become. It's a terrifying expression. I'm undone, disintegrated. I'm ruined. And let's say this. All of us, even in our darkest moments, will only ever experience this in part. Hebrews chapter 1 makes a great point. It says that God is still holding the world together with his power. In spite of sin, in spite of evil, in spite of the choices we make and the way that we live, he's still holding things together. Whatever disintegration we face is only ever partial. Imagine what would happen if God gave up on all of it. Just gave the human race what it wants. You know what we want? We want to be free. We want to live as we please. We want to be free from God's presence. Just leave us alone, God. If he finally did that, the disintegration would be total. The book of Exodus. Exodus talks about the 10 plagues in Egypt. Remember the 10 plagues? They weren't just magic tricks. They were a foretaste of what begins to happen when the world falls apart. Foretastes of God removing himself and giving us what we want. We're going back to Genesis 1 verse 0 again. The horror of uncreation, of darkness and chaos. When Moses raises up the rod of God's justice over Egypt, they began to experience the horror of uncreation. Water didn't work as water anymore. turned to blood. The sun didn't work as light and life anymore. There was darkness, lice, gnats, flies, frogs, disease, boils. Nature doesn't work the way nature was supposed to work. And then in the end, the firstborn children all died. What was that? Death. Death, the ultimate horror of uncreation. All the prophets say that if God finally gave the human race what it wants, that's doomsday. Chaos, disintegration, emptiness, darkness. Jeremiah talks about what the world will be like. He says, Jeremiah 4, verse 23, I looked at the earth, and it was formless and empty. Genesis 1, 0. And I looked at the heavens, and their light was gone. Isaiah chapter 13 described it this way. It said, the rising sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the heavens themselves will tremble, and the earth will shake. That's the darkness we face. Let's think about the darkness that Jesus faced. Verse 34, chapter 15 of Mark. At the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, my God, my God, why are you forsaking me? What's going on? As darkness descends on Jesus, he's become the focal point of all human evil. I mean, hasn't he? Every bit of human malice and cruelty that we could throw at someone gets hurled at Jesus. He's been rejected by a people that he thought were his own. He is a man without a country. He's been sacrificed to political expediency by the Roman government, a victim of injustice. He's been abandoned by all of his closest friends. They're just out trying to save their skins, relational betrayal. He's been tortured. He's being killed. It's everything that human beings in their worst moments could conjure up. But that's not all he's getting. That's just human evil. This is bigger. This is a kind of eerie supernatural darkness. When Jesus Christ starts crying out, he doesn't say, my friends, why have you abandoned me? Or my head, why have you wounded me? My hands, my feet, why have you crucified me? What does he say? My God. For those brutal moments, he experiences what the world would be without God. All the plagues, all the horror of uncreation coming down now on him. The ultimate in unrelenting darkness. And it's all falling on him. Hebrews 1 verse 2 says that God holds all things together. Any McMaster University grads? That's the university motto. Did you know that? In Christ, all things hold together. But they write it in Greek, so you don't know that. For Jesus, it's all unraveling. He's being engulfed in darkness. He's experiencing the absolute infinite disintegration, the unraveling of soul and body. It's astounding, but do you know why it's astounding? Because here you have Jesus, the maker of the world, and he is being unmade. Here's the Lord of all creation who steps into the world that he's made, and instead of inflicting all the horrors of darkness and uncreation on sinners, he bears them himself. It's all coming down on Jesus. And as horrible as it must have been to have a spear thrust into the side, to die of suffocation, to have been tortured and beaten, thorns pressed into your scalp, nails into your hands and your feet, he doesn't say a thing about that. Because compared to this, that's a flea bite. Jesus is experiencing the cosmic horror of uncreation. Of God-forsakenness, of a world without its creator. The words Isaiah spoke but never experienced describe that unthinkable reality for Jesus. Woe is me, I am undone. That's the darkness Jesus was facing. But that's not all there is to the story. If you get to the very end of the passage, which is actually the climax of the entire Gospel of Mark, Mark shows us how the darkness that we face and the darkness that Jesus faced come together, and they actually cancel each other out. They break open and dispel darkness. How so? Let's look at these two verses. Mark 15, verses 38 and 39. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who was standing there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, and here it is, surely this man was the Son of God. That great temple curtain, nothing like the flimsy little shears that you and I have hanging in our living room. It was so thick, so hard, that it came down like a wall. It came down in front of the Holy of Holies. It separated that sacred place where it was thought that God's Shekinah glory dwelled, where God's holiness dwelled. It separated it from the rest of the temple, from the people. And only the holiest man, the high priest, on the holiest day, Yom Kippur, a descendant of the holiest people in the world, God's so-called chosen ones, the holiest man from the holiest people on the holiest day, only after offering blood sacrifice, he would go in there one day a year and pray for the salvation of his people. Only the most holy, only the most moral, only the most pure, and only one day. And even then, everyone was scared to death. They tied a rope around his foot so that if he died on the spot, they could pull him out. The minute Jesus took his last breath, that incredibly thick curtain was shredded from top to bottom. And when it was ripped, don't miss this, it was God's way of saying, this is the sacrifice that ends all sacrifices. Now anyone can go in. Anyone can see God. Anyone can connect to God. You don't have to be the holiest of the holy. You don't have to be the most moral of the moral. Anybody, the barrier's gone. And to make sure that we don't miss the point, immediately after the curtain is torn, Mark shows us the first man to go in. And unexpectedly, who is it? It's a Roman centurion, a pagan. I said this is the climax of the book of Mark, and I mean it. I mean, if you remember how Mark started, Mark chapter 1, verse 1, this is the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. He gives away the ending. He tells you right up front, Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God. But up to this point, no human being has really figured out what that means. Over and over again throughout his ministry, Jesus does amazing things, teaches compelling truths. He upends our misguided assumptions about God. And people keep asking, who is this man? Who is he? The first man who finally gets it, gets all of it, a centurion. I mean, first of all, he's Roman. When he says, surely this man is the Son of God, the word Son of God for a Roman would only have ever been used for one person, for Caesar. On every single coin minted that day, it said, Tiberius Caesar, Son of God. The only person a Roman would ever say that about would be Caesar. But here he says, no, we've got it wrong. Here's the Son of God. It's Mark's way of showing what the ripping of the curtain means. The sacrifice to end all sacrifices. You don't have to be holy. God will make you holy. You don't have to be moral. But God will give you a compass. Look at who this guy is. He's not a disciple of Jesus. He's not even a Jew. Spiritually, he's lived his life in the dark. He doesn't know the Bible. He's trapped in ignorance. But more than that, centurions aren't aristocrats given some token promotion. These are enlisted men who'd risen up through the ranks, hardened by years of battle. He'd seen death. He'd inflicted death. He'd lived this life of absolute brutality. And here's a man who'd lived in absolute darkness, and yet something penetrated in that moment. He becomes the first person to confess Jesus Christ and really understand what that meant. It's a whole new world. But you have to ask, what happened? What is it that pierced the darkness? When I first studied the Gospel of Mark 33 years ago, I was told this was the climax of the Gospel. I've been thinking about it ever since. Why was this centurion the first man who actually gets it? It's still amazing to me. Mark gives us the answer. He heard Jesus' final cry, and he saw how he died. I've been there a few times, not a lot, but a few times in that moment when somebody draws their final breath. Most of us don't see when people die. We hear about it, we grieve it. This guy was different. This centurion, he'd seen lots of people die, many of them under his own hand. He was a brutal man, seen innumerable deaths, but there was something about this that was unique. Something about Jesus' death that was unlike anything he'd seen. Something about the tenderness of that moment that must have pierced right through all of the hardness. Something about the beauty of Jesus' death that pierced through the darkness. What did he see? Well, we can't know exactly, but notice what the text says. Mark gives you a hint. He heard Jesus cry. If you think about what that cry means, my God, my God, why have you forsaken me? You begin to see the same beauty, tenderness. Darkness begins to lift. Hardness in our lives begins to melt. And lives begin to change, just like this man's life was changed. What did Jesus cry out? My God. My God. It's a cry of intimacy, isn't it? If at the end of this service, one of you comes to me and says, I never want to talk to you again. I never want to see you again. I'll feel pretty bad about it. But I'll get on with my life. If at the end of the service, my wife comes up to me and says, I never want to talk to you again. I never want to see you again. That's a whole lot worse, isn't it? Some of you know that pain, to lose a spouse in death or in divorce. Counselors will say that is the most traumatic human event that can happen. The longer you love, the deeper you love, the greater is the torment of loss. There's no torment like the loss of a loved one. Nothing else. Nothing even compares. But look, this is the Father and the Son. They've been loving each other since the fountain of all eternity. The greatest love between two human beings in the history of the world is nothing compared to this. This is infinite, infinitely long, infinitely perfect. And here it's disintegrating in these moments. He's in hell. No one has ever suffered like this. No one. And there's something else. As you hear him cry out, my God, why have you forsaken me? You realize that no one has ever obeyed God like this. For every other person who has ever lived, the promise was this: if you obey me, if you give yourself to me, I will give myself to you and you will live. That's the promise. True for you, true for me, true for every person in the history of the world, except one. For Jesus, trusting God means this. And notice, he doesn't say, cruel father, vindictive father. No, he says, my God. My God. Even while he's being damned. This has never happened before. It will never happen again. It's unbelievable. I mentioned literature at the beginning. Some of you suffered through the long, long, long text of Herman Melville's Moby Dick. And you stayed with it because you knew there was that one quote coming at the end that Moby Dick is famous for. When Captain Ahab is going down into a watery grave, when he points to Moby Dick and says, from hell's heart, I stab at thee. And for hate's sake, I spit my last breath at thee. Very dramatic. But it's just rhetoric. He wasn't in hell's heart. Yeah, he was going to die, but that's not hell's heart. But there was someone who really was. What does he say? From hell's heart, I will love you. From hell's heart, I will hold you. I'm holding on, and I will not let go. You are his passion. There's no greater revelation of the passion of Jesus Christ than those words. No one has obeyed God like this. No one has been faithful and trusted God like this. Last question. An unanswerable question? I don't know. Why? No one's ever suffered like this. Nobody has ever obeyed at such countless cost. Why? The answer is you. Turns out it's not an unanswerable question. For you, for me, for all of us. Look, the centurion, he didn't have the theological categories to define it, but he had the Holy Spirit, I believe. He had the intuition to grasp the beauty of it. And it ripped through the hardness of his life, and it ripped through the darkness. When you really see the meaning of those words, my God, why have you forsaken me? It will melt your heart. I don't care who you are. It will open your eyes. It will shatter the darkness. And again, I don't care what your journey has been. You will be able to turn from the other things that are dominating your life, the things that are addicting you, the things that are drawing you off into darkness. And if you say, this is the one that I want, and I want it more than anything else in the world, this is the one I've tried to find in all of the other things, in romance, in career, and I never got it. This is what I was looking for, even when I didn't know it. Curtain ripped from top to bottom, barrier gone. Doesn't matter who you are, what you've done. If you've been camping out just inside the gates of hell for years, it doesn't matter. There's mercy for you. And then we'll just finish with this. Let me say a word to those of you who are in the midst right now of a season of suffering. You're going through something really hard. If you're a human being, you've either gone through it recently, or you soon will, or you're in the middle of it right now. That's just life. When you suffer, when you find yourself crying out, why? Why, God, why? Christianity is the only faith that responds by saying, you know, God spoke those same words. Why? Why, God? Why have you forsaken me? When you realize that, you can no longer talk to God the same way. You no longer have any doubt that he's abandoned you, that he doesn't love you. You know that he does. And it's enough. It's enough to get you through. Because of this, there is an ocean of love and joy out there for us. And even though we're temporarily trapped in this little tiny piece of darkness, it's microscopic. Evil is a passing thing. There's light and high beauty. Tolkien's beautiful phrase. There is light and high beauty forever. Beyond the reach of evil, because of Jesus, hold on to him, and he will not let you go. On the way into the service, you were given one of these cards and a pencil. I'm going to ask you to find it now. If you don't have one, just raise your hands. Someone or our Gateway team will get it to you. Jesus' final declaration, "It is finished," was his heart's cry for you. Jesus was cast out so we could be brought back. He was rejected so we could be welcomed. The darkness of sin and shame and even death itself was dispelled in that one victorious moment. Worship team are going to come and lead us in song. And as we're singing together, I'm going to ask you to respond to what God has done and what he can do in your life. On the back of the card, I encourage you to write something down. Something in your life. Some darkness that you still feel has a grip on you. Write it down. Or maybe there's something in your life that God has healed in you and you want to thank him for that. Write it down. And then as we're singing, I'm going to invite you sort of row by row to come forward and place them at the foot of the cross. It's where it all happened. Darkness canceled out darkness and light has come. We're going to give a few minutes for you to write and discern as the worship team play quietly. And then we're going to sing. And then as we sing, I'm going to just signal section by section for people to come forward. There are four baskets here on the front of the stage. Find your place at the foot of the cross.